You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church.
One of the most immediate transformations in my life when I did become a Christian was while my pursuit of excellence didn't go away, the motivation and the reason for that pursuit had a complete 180. We get to participate in helping convey the manifold wisdom of God that just keeps revealing new nooks and crannies of itself. But at some point, you're going to have to move away from propositional knowledge and get into experiential knowledge. You're going to have to experience this and really see who he is and whether he's worth following and living for.
This is Rebecca McLaughlin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kyle Worley, and also by my good friend, Dr. Praveen Sathupathy. Praveen is a professor of physiological genomics in the Department of Biomedical Sciences and director of the Center for Vertebrate Genomics at Cornell University, no less, where he leads a research lab focused on genomic approaches to understanding physiology and human disease. Praveen received his BA degree from Cornell University once upon a time and his PhD in genomics from the University of Pennsylvania. And it is such a delight to have you chatting with us today, brother.
Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
You are so welcome.
I got to tell you, that's one of the most impressive bios we have ever read on any show that I've hosted. It feels like a real statement. So I'm thrilled to have you on the show. Thanks, Praveen.
So here's one of the things... One of the things I love about Praveen is that he started at Cornell and now he's back at Cornell, and that actually bookends, well, not bookends, your story, pray God, will continue for many, many years to come. But I actually wanted to start our conversation, Praveen, by taking you back to the beginning when you were first at Cornell.
Yeah.
And hearing a bit of, like, describe to us 18-year-old Praveen or whatever, you know, maybe you were 15 and a child prodigy. But when you first went off to Cornell, tell us about yourself, both like personally and spiritually at that point, and how those first few years in Ithaca, New York changed you.
Yeah, sure. So when I was 17, which is when I arrived on the Cornell campus, for all of my life, I had grown up in an Orthodox Hindu home. And that was my exposure to spiritual life. And it was rich. And it's such a long tradition that you've never really captured all of it. Right? Mm. So I was embedded in the culture and the immigrant experience, as I think many immigrant families will agree. You're holding on to the values and traditions and cultures and religion of the motherland, perhaps even more tightly than people back home even are, right? Mm-hmm. So it was very much a kind of two worlds that I was living in. You know, in my home, it was, the experience was very traditional. And I was exposed to a lot of the rituals and practices of Hinduism quite regularly. Somehow along the way, I did develop this sense that God, if he existed, was personal in the sense that he could hear me, he wanted to hear me, that there was an opportunity or option for relationship. This wasn't necessarily something that was explicitly taught to me. So in retrospect, I see it as, you know, the heavy hand, in a positive way of the Holy Spirit. But I did cultivate this sense that God was real, and that he could hear me and I could talk to him. But beyond that, really religion was practicing a set of rituals and using the kind of values that religion taught to build community. So that's really sort of how I thought about it. When I got to Cornell, I was asked by my roommate on the first day that I was there about what I believed. And this really challenged me because I could not provide a succinct answer for what Hinduism meant to me. And I was really surprised by that. And I hadn't really even ever been challenged to answer that question. So that took me down a long road of studying Hinduism. And then once I became even more aware of some of the truth claims of Hinduism, I became really keenly interested in comparing those truth claims to those of other faith traditions that I was only sort of peripherally aware of, right? Buddhism and Judaism and Islam and Christianity. So it was an incredibly rich time for me. And it was wonderful to be at Cornell because there were imams I could talk to and Hindu priests I could connect with. And so as I was studying these different traditions, I could try to connect with folks who were practitioners and ask them questions and watch them worship and try to connect with those communities and learn a little bit more kind of boots on the ground about how they practice their faith. That was really valuable for me. But one of the things that was very quickly disabused of was this notion that we could all sort of hold hands and sing Kumbaya because we were all pointing to the same thing. I actually sort of desperately wanted that to be true and thought that that would be quite convenient and comfortable. But increasingly, as I made those explorations, I felt I was being intellectually dishonest with myself. It felt that I was not respecting those traditions the way that they deserved to be if I was going to simply paper over them that way. The other thing that I'll share is that, you know, when I arrived on this campus, getting straight A's, going to an Ivy League school, worldly success, was really what drove me. That was my religion, even though I was raised as a Hindu. That was really my religion. And one of the most immediate transformations in my life when I did become a Christian in college was that while my pursuit of excellence didn't go away, the motivation and the reason for that pursuit had a complete 180.
Interesting. So you casually remarked that you became a Christian. But I think Kyle and other listeners who haven't heard your story before may be interested to hear just more. So you've talked us through being raised in a Hindu context and then exploring these different religious traditions, realizing that actually it wasn't just like all of the above, but you probably had to choose. So why would you land on Christianity?
A lot of reasons, and probably don't have time to get into all of those, but a couple of really important things that I'll mention. You know, when it came to sort of values like the golden rule, I did not find these to be uniquely biblical. Variations on that theme were present in many faith traditions. Right? But what really blew me away was the person of Jesus. That, you know, that someone, not something, that person, not precept, is really what blew me away. Because I had not encountered anybody like that until then. And since, other than Jesus himself, here was a person who's the supposed kind of hero of the story, who was naked and disfigured and barely recognizable on the cross. And among his final words were those of forgiveness to those that had put him there. Truly, I experienced what stumbling block meant, because it was almost difficult to read and get through the first couple of times I tried to. It really was quite... went against the grain of everything I expected from the hero of a story. And I had been used to different kinds of heroes like Krishna or Muhammad. And there was a sense in which I resonated with those heroes. You know, when Krishna was challenged, he'd become 60 foot tall and use his chakra. And there's a kind of superhero mentality to that, that I think we all resonate with at some level. It's why we like DC Comics and Marvel. not to reduce those faiths to just, you know, comics, but we do really like to think about our gods as almost demigods, kind of like us, but way more powerful and way more interesting and cool. And so there's a sense in which I resonated with those. But when I came to Jesus, it was so different from anything that I had ever read or and anticipated. And what I began to realize is he was disabusing me of this notion of what it meant to be powerful, right? Normally, we're used to seeing people exercise their power by, you know, imposing their supposed superiority on someone, and usually sometimes by force. And not all that was lacking. It was this laying down of life in order to bring new life, this sense in which I'm not going to be interested in my needs at this moment whatsoever, but I'm going to act solely for the benefit of others. This was really a 180 for me, and it did not make me immediately a Christian, but it kept pulling me back because it was just so countercultural. And it was not easy to understand, but it was very powerful.
Yeah. When you went back to your family, Praveen, and told them that you had become a Christian, I'm sort of curious, and others might be curious to hear, like, How did your family react? I mean, having you describe the sort of immigrant experience of wanting perhaps to hold on to pieces of that have feel like strong identifying markers from the original country that your parents had come from. It must have been pretty disorienting for them, for you to become a Christian. Like, talk us through what that process was like.
Yeah, disorienting, I think, is an understatement. It was devastating. It was devastating and extraordinarily confusing. Hmm. Being a Hindu, a Brahmin Hindu in particular, is really wrapped up in your identity of being a certain kind of Indian. Hmm. And embracing that history, that culture, that tradition. So when you walk away from that faith, many people interpret it as walking away from being an Indian. Hmm. Maybe even, accepting the religion of the oppressor. And, you know, Hinduism is a really, really interesting tradition in that it just, part of the reason why I think it continues to thrive, many of its contemporaries, like Zoroastrianism, they're not thriving necessarily today in the way that Hinduism is. And I think part of that is because it's kind of like the English language. It just takes on new words and makes it its own, right? And so it really evolves with the times. In a way that is, it enables sustainability and thriving. It also makes it hard to define because it means something different to so many different practitioners, right? But the bottom line is that to reject that in favor of something that is perceived as an exclusionary faith or religion, and worse, perceived as a Western religion by so many, it was very, very devastating, and it felt as though I was even rejecting the family. It took years, and for some people, decades, Rebecca, for me to dispel those misconceptions and misperceptions, to convey that Christ's calling in my life was not on my name, was not on, you know, the color of my skin, was not on the language that I spoke and the foods I ate and the traditions I experienced. But rather was centered on something much, much greater, right? Who I am, who I'm called to be, who I'm made to be, and his relationship with us and what that means for my life. It's on that level and on that order. And if anything, I became even more passionate about being an Indian and about my culture and my tradition and my past and my family roots. But it took a long time to convey those truths and realities. It was very confusing. And in their defense, this is what many people have done. They've become Christian and changed their name or the way they dress or, you know, how they speak. And those are not the things Christ came to claim.
Yeah, yeah. You've mentioned the word identity there, Praveen, and I just wanted to draw in kind of another thread because, as we mentioned at the beginning, you know, you went to Cornell to pursue science and you've come back to Cornell to pursue science. I think many listeners will be surprised to hear that a kid went off to college to study science and found Jesus in that process. So talk us through your experience there. Like, have you found, as you've become a Christian, you know, already with a keen interest in science, have you found that your scientific pursuits have sort of pulled you away from Christianity, or like tell us more about that story?
Oh no, not at all. Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. One of my favorite verses in Scripture is 1 Thessalonians 5:21, and some translations of it say, "Test everything, and then hold fast to that which is beautiful." I just really, really love that, right? Because a lot of people misconceive that faith is about rejecting doubt. I don't actually see it that way. I see God as embracing the doubt and the healthy skepticism that we bring to the table. I think he wants us to test. I think he wants us to have discernment and not just walk into things blindly. That's chaos, right? But God gives us the tools, a variety of different kinds of tools, to be able to test. And at the end of the day, that's sort of the scientific process, is to, you know, observe before us, some particular phenomena or a set of data that underlies a phenomena, and to do the tests that are necessary to determine which model explains that data best. Mm-hmm. That's really what we do. Some people think we're in the business of proving things. But generally, we're not. to really prove something in the way that people normally think is few and far between. And generally, what we're doing is accumulating evidence in favor of one explanatory model over another. And so seen through that lens, the way that I came to Christian faith was not so different from that. I didn't have a lot of the baggage of having grown up in a Christian home. And so it was sort of a fresh slate for me to evaluate. And the same was true of not having grown up in a Muslim home or a Buddhist home. So as I evaluated all of those faith traditions, I had the opportunity to try to approach it with as open of a mind as possible. And I'm really grateful for that. Because I do think it provided a sense of clarity and not being occluded by other people's expectations of how I should be perceiving these things. Now, actually, that became harder when I became a Christian and was sort of given an evangelical lens to try to see the world. But we can talk about that later if there's time. Here, what I really want to say is that I had the opportunity to evaluate the truth claims in the best way that I could. With Christianity and Islam, to a large extent, a lot of these claims are historical. So you can do really careful literary analysis, you know, study of people's archaeological studies, the extra biblical sources and context for various claims from the Bible itself. So I threw myself into those kinds of things because I thought, what I'm really dealing with here are claims about who God is. This is weighty stuff. I'm not just going to walk into it because it feels good or it doesn't feel good. I want to really do my homework and do my due diligence. And I think that's the first half of 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test everything.
Yeah.
So I think there was a scientific mindset there. But there's a myth that people have that of certainty. This notion that you can use a scientific approach and arrive at 100% certainty, that's rarely ever the case. And I think by and large, it's a myth. There's a wonderful book called The Myth of Certainty by Daniel Taylor. I actually was very influential for me, and I recommend for your listeners. Super thoughtful book about what it means to be a reflective Christian, one who embraces the fact that God not only allows but encourages us to test, right, and to discern, but at the same time to embrace the truth and the reality that there is a point we will reach when we have to take a leap of faith, when we have to embrace the risk of commitment. That's true in our everyday lives as we develop friendships and expose ourselves vulnerably, as we decide to propose to someone, to become married, as it is when we decide, you know, when we make a decision about who we think God is and dive into a personal relationship with Him. So the life is, there's a beauty and an intermixing there where you do at some point have to be willing to take that leap of faith. The evidence isn't going to bring you all the way there. It's going to help you to realize whether or not this is worth exploring further. But at some point, you're going to have to move away from propositional knowledge and get into experiential knowledge. You're going to have to experience this and really see who He is and whether He's worth following and living for.
Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness His resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, Seminary President Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and His command to go to the nations with His gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold.
Praveen, before we take this towards like the big question of the episode, we're talking about science. I'm not playing a part here. I'm genuinely somebody whose literacy in terms of scientific endeavors is low. Okay. This isn't a gimmick, brother. Okay. I genuinely am. This is not my wheelhouse. It's not my strength. And when Rebecca suggested having you on, my first feeling was absolute terror. she immediately said you were very kind, and you are, and you're so articulate. Can I just ask this? I feel like people that are listening to this, Christians that might be tuning into this podcast, we have a lot of folks that listen to this because they are thinking critically about their faith. We just kind of throw science around. Like, we bandy that term about just like it can mean anything. And sometimes it's invoked with a kind of like sacredness, or sometimes it's invoked with a kind of like definitiveness. And I'm just curious, when we're talking about science, what are we actually talking about? Like, what is science? Before we ask, can science dictate our identity? What is science? I mean, like, is it a book somewhere? Is it secret knowledge? Is it a process? Is it an endeavor? Is it a quest? What is science?
Kyle, what a brilliant question. I think in all of my years, you know, answering these kinds of questions or doing these kinds of events, I don't know that anybody has actually asked that. And even in the spirit of just defining terms and making sure people are on the same page, what a useful thing to do. Thank you for asking me that.
Yeah.
And you might actually get, you know, slightly different definitions from different scientists, maybe even, right? So it's really worth asking. I think about science as a human endeavor.
Okay.
It can lead to a body of knowledge and truth that we refer to as scientific knowledge.
Okay.
But I think of science as a human endeavor. It's a set of tools that we use, incorporating logic and mathematics and tools and precepts and theories from other sciences that human beings have developed through our faculties, right, given to us by God, to make sense of the world, right? All kinds of phenomena around us, right? Yeah. Whether it be physical phenomena or chemical phenomena or biological phenomena. And so it's using material tools and the knowledge that those tools can help bring us in order to better understand those phenomena, right? Yeah. So what are natural explanations for the things we see in the natural world?
That's really helpful.
That last statement there, Praveen, is an interesting one. You said you're looking for natural explanations to things that we see in the natural world. Now, some people would kind of jump from that to say, okay, the project of science is finding alternative explanations to God, right? You know, once upon a time, people needed this idea of a God who created us and who, you know, made us in his image and loves us and like it sustains the universe or whatever. But today, scientists like you and your colleagues have figured out like what Kyle Woolley is, what Rebecca McLaughlin, like we've come up with like a scientific explanation for how human beings came to be, for every like atom and cell in our bodies. We've got a scientific understanding of how we work. So why would we then still need to invoke these religious understandings of what a human being is? Like, help us understand how, if science is not just kind of replacing God, help us to understand what's going on there.
Yeah, Rebecca, that's a really good question too, because I think that both people with a faith-based worldview and without can fall prey to this problem and start to think, well, oh my gosh, science has essentially pushed God outside and we really don't need this explanation anymore, right? There are a few things that I want to say in response to this. One is that, you know, as a Christian, my framework is different, right? Mm. I don't see natural explanations on one side and supernatural explanations on the other. And as we increasingly find that there are natural explanations for, human speciation, or there are natural explanations for a rainbow, or whatever it might be that in, you know, centuries past, we may have ascribed to something more supernatural, that somehow that starts to push the supernatural away. That assumes that God is the author of supernatural things and not the author of natural things. Right? Mm-hmm. And to me, God sits above all of this, right? To find a natural explanation for something does not take away the authorship of God. Right? If there's a natural explanation for something, I find myself worshiping God when I discover that, just as readily as I do if I think there's a supernatural explanation like the resurrection of Christ. both fall under the purview of God. And to me, nothing, one isn't actually more amazing than another. Hmm. We've somehow cast aside natural things as boring and supernatural things as really cool that require God. Mm-hmm. But the question still remains, how did those natural things come into play? Who is the author of these natural things, right? Yeah. So as a Christian, I think that it's important for me to convey that the way that I think about it is different. The second thing I would say is, boy, science is incredibly powerful at arriving at mechanistic explanations for phenomena. That's what we do, right? And that's what I just said in different terms. But science is not really a useful set of tools for trying to arrive at meaning or purpose, right? Or the why of things. And this is really beautifully explained in, a little example that John Polkinghorne gives. And, you know, for your listeners, if you're not familiar with Polkinghorne, please become familiar with him. He's just a phenomenal human being. He was a renowned physicist turned Anglican priest. And so really did swim in both pools and gave this example of, you know, if you see a tea kettle that's boiling, right, and you ask the question, why is the tea kettle boiling, right? You could answer that in at least a couple of different ways. One would be you get into the chemistry of how the heat makes the water boil that way, right? And you can kind of delve into that and you'd be absolutely right. And you might call that a natural explanation, right? But then you could say it's because I wanted a cup of tea.
Right.
Which gets at a higher order reason, mm-hmm. For why that tea kettle is boiling. Right. It gets at the fact that there's a purpose behind this. There's an agent behind this, right, that wanted something and so did that. They're not contradictory. They don't oppose or they're not antagonistic toward one another. They're just on different dimensions of reality. And so science is really good at getting at that first one. I don't know of anything better. But it's impotent to arrive at any conclusion with regard to the second. At best, it's agnostic about that. And so what we now know is it can neither prove nor disprove God or some kind of agent behind everything. But what it does is what it doesn't do is constrain us to think that it is the only thing that can provide a sense of who we are, our identity, or why we're here.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned the resurrection a couple of minutes ago, Praveen, and that makes me curious. Maybe some of our listeners will be curious. You know, we talked about God as the creator who sort of stands over everything that we could look at through science and isn't, you know, is as much involved in the natural processes as in supernatural moments. How do you as a scientist think about miracles? I mean, those moments like the resurrection, obviously the central miracle of the Christian faith, but also like Jesus' healing miracles, the way that he calmed the storm just by speaking. Within your understanding of the universe, like as a scientist, is there room for miracles like actually happening in history, you know, not just like some people say, well, Jesus' resurrection was maybe a kind of story that people told without a real historical foundation, or maybe it was like a resurrection in the hearts of his disciples, like a sort of such a spiritual thing that it didn't have like real bodily implications. Like help us to understand how you as a scientist can believe in a miracle like the resurrection.
I've no problem with the miracle at all, Rebecca. And in fact, miracles have never really bothered me. If God is to exist, because I think you can kick the can down the road on a question like this and just say, well, you know, do you have a problem with there being a God as a scientist? Really is really what it boils down to. Because if you don't, he can do whatever he wants, however he wants, right? I mean, there really is no conflict at all. I can understand emotionally how people feel, well, gosh, if you're just going to, everything that happens, you're going to say it's a miracle. That's a different question, right? Yep. But can miracles exist? Can they happen? Well, if God is real, then absolutely. That's the very definition of God. He can do whatever he pleases. He can more or less allow things to go through the physical laws that he's set up. And he can break those physical laws without breaking the world if he pleases, because he's God. Right?
Yeah.
I don't have any problem with it at all. And again, it comes back to this notion of whether you think science is the sole arbiter of truth. Is it the only dimension with which we can understand our reality, right? And I think on a smaller scale, Rebecca, we've been asking this question over and over again in human history. Sometimes we think this is like a super modern question, given how advanced we are in science. Mm. But if we go all the way back, you know, the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, right? That this was a response to a blind faith, dark ages, right? Mm-hmm. And what emerged out of that was this notion that science is superior to other all ways of knowing, all ways of approaching truth and knowledge. But then in response to that was the Romantic period, right? Yeah. Where it was said, gosh, you are reducing our reality to a single dimension where, you know, the truth of who we are is just a cold, sterile object of study, right? Mm-hmm. There's no life to it, right? And while that might be a real dimension, what is it about science that demands us to believe there's no other dimension? Yeah. We're not finding any, right? And so there was a reaction to that, you know, it's really our heart and our intuition that define who we are, that teach us about deeper features and spiritual truths of the world that science and logic alone cannot illuminate. What I love is the statement of Madeleine L'Engle, a really famous American author who wrote a lot on science and faith, where she said that your heart and your intuition and your intellect and your logic, they need to intermingle and make love. Mm. If you are to really know who you are, really understand the dimensions of knowledge. And I really love that. And I think that's the reality of my experience. And if we're honest, probably many people would really feel like, yeah, it's, you know, a lot of things that I kind of know to be true and real, they weren't arrived at by a set of logical propositions or a mathematical theorem.
Yeah, yeah. I have historian friends, Praveen, who always get upset when people talk about the dark ages of ignorance, because it does rather undervalue much of the intellectual exploration that went on before then, which I'm sure you know. But I think the Enlightenment, in some ways, sort of wrote a convenient history behind itself.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
Posturing the past there, but sort of to take us back even further into the past. You know, some people would say, okay, so say you have a scientific explanation now of the beginning of the world, the origins of humans, like how everything came to be. And like say even from a Christian perspective, okay, you can say that, like, yeah, there's a creator God who made these things. Now we understand scientifically how this happened. Why would we then be interested in a text like Genesis 1 and 2? Like why would we look to the first two chapters of the Bible as a source of powerful and meaningful truth, if we have a scientific explanation for the kinds of phenomena that we're hearing about in Genesis 1 and 2? Help us to think through that.
I think the answer to that is that because Genesis 1 and 2, at least in my understanding and reading and that of many other scholars, isn't about it's not an exposition on the scientific origin of humans. It's not to say that isn't interesting, but that isn't the primary subject matter of Genesis 1 and 2. Mm. I think a lot of scholarly work has arrived at the fact that there's something very different going on in Genesis 1 and 2. There's polemical stuff. There's a response potentially to other traditions at that time. But really, it's establishing who God is and who humans are intended to be. And what the relationship is between God and humans. Why did God make humans? The ancients were obsessed with this question. There are many different answers floating around in Genesis 1 and 2. It just kind of comes piercing through and it says, love. I made you because this is good. And to me, good, in my best understanding, is, you know, there are created spaces, there are created things, and created things doing what they were meant to do in those created spaces is good, right? That's what God intended. That's what was meant to be. There's something so wonderful and beautiful. We weren't birthed of pain. We weren't birthed for slave labor. We weren't birthed for, you know, anything other than the fact that God wanted to be in relationship with us and that conferred upon us this wonderful moniker, this image of God, this vocation to represent him and reflect him on this earth. And throughout the decades and centuries and millennia to learn more and more about what that meant right? That we would never stop uncovering more about who God was. You know, like Johannes Kepler said, I'm just thinking God's thoughts after him. And the coolest thing about being a scientist is I get to not just discover that, but then share that with the world. Like in Ephesians, where it says that, you know, that we get to, uniquely, we get to participate in helping convey not only to others, but even the angels, the manifold wisdom of God.
Yeah.
That just keeps revealing new nooks and crannies of itself.
Wow. Well, that's about as good a place as you could to land the plane. Praveen, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it, brother.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Praveen.
Absolutely. Listen, if you want to find Confronting Christianity, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter. Leave a review on iTunes, and in your review, drop a question. Rebecca and I will take it into consideration for a future episode. If you want to find out more about what we have going on, you can check out trainingthechurch.com/support. Thanks again to Dr. Praveen for joining us today. Shout out to Upstate New York and Cornell. sounds beautiful. Sounds lovely. Have to go check it out. Thank you. Hope you enjoyed the discussion. Grace and peace.
And truth. I'm going to start adding truth. And truth.
Well, there we go.
Grace and peace.
Grace and peace and truth. Thank you, Rebecca.